Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
It's time for This Is Money, the show and podcast presented in partnership with NS&I. And joining me in the studio is the editor, Simon Lambert, from the award-winning This Is Money website, of course. Simon, hello.
Hello.
And we've got the personal finance editor, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, alongside as well. Hi.
Hello.
Nice of you both to join us. This week, we're looking at a new cash injection. It's the new Fiverr.
We're introducing them because we think that they're more secure, cleaner and stronger. And the public seem to really like this with the bright new designs.
Meanwhile, the bank's recent monetary policy change has created a backlash.
Let me say this about the banks. The banks have no excuse with today's announcement not to pass on this cut in bank rate. And they should write to their customers and make that point.
The Financial Conduct Authority is about to take a very close look at mortgage lenders as reports are out suggesting they're using a rate cut to punish savers without helping borrowers.
I think over the course of the next 2 to 3 months, people will start to look for signals in terms of what the post-Brexit scenario will look like.
And these punitive cuts to savings rates might be taking effect and denting confidence even further as high street inflation figures give very unsteady results.
I think over the course of the next 2 to 3 months, people will start to look for signals in terms of what the post-Brexit scenario will look like.
And as consumer confidence wavers, our trust in the pension system is plummeting through the floor, creating a pensions roadblock.
I think the massive problem with pensions is that it's just too big. People don't know enough about it, so they ostrich and they don't really know what to do about it or where to turn.
Our woes don't end there, as we see even holidaymakers getting overstretched on what is supposed to be time away from all of this.
What our research has shown is that a third of people had to rely on overdraft facilities or credit cards to bridge the gap of that overspending.
Fortunately for us, This Is Money have some tips for travelling in style without breaking the bank. And finally, we'll be looking at how your data can be used against you in weapons of maths destruction.
If that algorithm were in the hands of your doctor could help you stay well, and that would be a great thing. Mm-hmm. But if that same algorithm were in the hands of an insurer, then they could anticipate your future illness.
But we're kicking it all off this week with the new Fiverr. We'll reveal who's on the face in a moment. But for now, we're asking, who would you put on it? Simon, who'd be up there in your choices?
Do they have to be dead?
I don't know what the rules are,
actually.
I'm not
sure what the rule is.
I would definitely want them to be, because there's always potential for something to go wrong, for some kind of scandal.
Yeah.
And then, oh, it's awkward, isn't it?
Can you imagine having to recall 440 million of them?
Well,
if someone is a bit naughty.
I don't think that with my nomination this is going to be a problem, because whilst they are alive, I'm sure that any scandal probably wouldn't take them off the Fiverr. I was going to nominate Keith Richards.
All right. You think he's lived hard enough already?
Yeah, I think Keith Richards on the Fiverr, definitely.
I'd push for a woman. I would say that, probably, wouldn't I? But I've no idea which significant lady I'd put on there. Someone like Edith Cavell or something like that. Frey, our reporter, said he put Terry Wogan on there. He says he doesn't care that he's Irish. It doesn't really matter. He still reckons he's a person of significant note in the UK. Right, listen, let's talk about who's actually on it and the note itself. The new £5 note is out. The Bank of England started circulating the first ever plastic fivers this week, with the former Prime Minister Winston Churchill adorning the face. It's printed on polymer rather than paper, though I imagine it's quite paper-like. The bank says it'll be cleaner, stronger and more secure. Around 440 million of the notes will be issued, which can last around 5 years longer than paper notes, which will be phased out. The old ones feature the prison reformer Elizabeth Fry and can be used in shops until they're withdrawn from circulation sometime in May 2017. Here's the chief cashier at the Bank of England, Victoria Cleland.
So the new £5 note, as you say, it's on polymer, which is a type of plastic. And we had a sort of research and development project in the bank for a number of years, really trying to think what is the best new note for the Bank of England and for the public. And we found that polymer notes, they're made of a type of plastic, and with the right security features on, they're much more difficult to counterfeit. They stay cleaner for longer, they're more durable, and if you put that together, you've got sort of much more difficult to counterfeit notes, better quality notes in your pocket, so sort of fewer tatty fibres. Also, because they're more durable, they're ultimately better for the environment, so we don't need to replace so many. So a number of key drivers, but really importantly, although we as a central bank thought this makes sense, we know that banknotes mean an awful lot to members of the public. So we had a public consultation, a number of roadshows. I was going all around the UK showing people the notes back in 2013 before the final decision, and a real sense of excitement and saying these notes are really cool. Some had used them in other countries, particularly Australia, Canada. So we're introducing them because we think that they're more secure, cleaner and stronger, and the public seem to really like this with the bright new designs.
Yeah, we're getting all excited about the fact they're new in the UK, but other countries have been using notes like this for a while, haven't they? I don't know if you've seen them yet, but if you have you been impressed with how they feel, how they look, how durable they are?
I've not seen one yet myself, but I have been to Australia where they use polymer notes.
Is it weird?
For some time. It's a little bit if you're used to paper notes, like we've always had, but I think people will soon get used to it. Although Lee Boyce, our reporter, was saying that apparently they have a tendency to stick together. So be careful that you're not spending £10 instead of five, people.
You've got to be really careful when you're peeling one off a wad then. Apparently they wash well as well. So if you tuck one in your jeans pocket and you forget about it, then all is not lost, Rachel.
It's true, although does that make people just more reckless and more likely to do it? I don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't seen one myself, but I've watched, geek that I am, enough videos and seen enough pictures that I really feel like I have a sense of what they're like. The slippery thing is what I would worry about as well.
So how quickly are we likely to see these in general circulation then? How quickly do they go round?
Well, the Bank of England says that you should probably expect to start seeing them over the next few weeks or month or so. So if you think about how often is it that you end up with a fiver, I guess, which is more often than it used to be, because the Bank of England a couple of years back actually pumped a load of extra fivers into circulation. It was off the back of the financial crisis and the recession, and they decided that we needed more fivers, more lower denomination banknotes. So there's more fivers going around, I think, than there previously were, or they sort of tailed off a bit. But I don't know, I suppose over the next 3-4 weeks, you probably end up with one. You'd definitely end up with one before Christmas, I would think.
Oh, I think so. I'm looking forward to seeing the first one. The paper ones, the existing lot, will be pulled from circulation as of May next year. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, it's May 2017. So they're not worthless yet. Don't go throwing them away or anything. And then when they get pulled from circulation, £5 notes can only be exchanged with the Bank of England.
This might seem a bit weird to people listening who thinks, hang on a minute, we're heading towards a cashless society. We're increasing, even for very small purchases, we're paying with a card or, you know, Apple Pay, something like that. So why worry about a new £5 note?
Well, I think that there's all this talk of a cashless society, isn't there? But in reality, there's still a huge amount of cash that goes around. And I think while some of the Bank of England's economists might quite like a cashless society because it would enable them to control the money supply and monetary policy that bit tighter, I think we're a long way off it, and I don't think we'll ever really see it. I mean, I personally am one of those people who quite often doesn't have any cash and tries to use a card for everything. But you've got to be wary with doing that, because quite often you get caught out and you can't actually use a card.
Yeah, well, you've been in situations where you ordered a cup of coffee and find that you've actually no means of paying it. Does he do that all the time?
I think it's I'm resisting this narrative of an inevitable cashless society with all my might, because it's a dangerous one. I think Simon's right. It's not a path that we want to go down. It gives too much power to banks. And maybe it doesn't matter, but it's the principle of it that every single transaction that you do can be traceable. And as we'll talk about later, with the proliferation of data that's being stored up about us, we don't necessarily know what it will be used for.
All right, sounding a note of caution. That we'll come on to a little later. Is this the most important thing that the Bank of England could be doing right now? All this time, all this effort, and presumably a great deal of expense that's gone into developing and issuing this new note?
It does have other fish to fry, but it's this is a tenuous analogy, but it is still frying them. I think it can sort of sideline in making sure that we're spending our money with the right sorts of things as well. We do have a huge problem as well with fraud. I mean, sometime next year we're getting our new pound coins as well, which isn't just a vanity project. It's just a huge number of the pound coins that are now in circulation are imposters. They're particularly easy to copy, and I suppose the denomination that's most worthwhile to copy. So, and it's part of the Bank of England's job to keep on track of that as well, and also to make sure that the credibility of the stuff that we pay with is retained.
Okay, so plastic fivers coming soon to a wallet near you. Winston Churchill features on them, and grabbing a bit more attention, I think, than the note itself is the fact that he's represented. Here's Kevin Pratt of Money Supermarket.
There are very few people who transcend most of the divisions in society, and Sir Winston Churchill would be one of those. So he's almost apolitical. He's obviously got his track record as a war hero. He won a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1953. A man of vast achievement, a controversial man in many ways. Certainly in the early part of the last century, he was involved in some very controversial incidents, both domestically and overseas in the theatre of war, but by and large regarded by the bulk of the population as a positive figure. So hence his grandstand appearance on the fiver.
Just while we were listening to what Kevin Pratt had to say, a genius idea from Simon Lambert. Can you share it with everybody else, not just us?
I think that instead of just having the person's picture on there, they should have a little box on there, a little sort of caption, you know, just telling us who they are and what they did. I mean, with Churchill, I guess it's pretty obvious for most people.
Why are you saying that? I reckon there's a whole generation of people who have no idea what he looked like and why he's deemed significant.
Maybe. But I think especially with some of the people who were a little bit more obscure, who, you know, how many people can spot exactly who those people are and what they did and why they're important? So I think we should put a little bit on there. Make our banknotes educational as well.
Yeah, well, a little kind of asterisk saying, if you don't know who this is, turn over.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
This is the This Is Money team. Here with me, Sue Dugan today, editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the financial website of the year. Now, Simon, let's look at some more substantial moves the Bank of England has been making of late, because the Financial Conduct Authority is taking a bit of a hard look at some of the bigger lenders to see if they've been punishing savers without helping borrowers following the bank's base rate cut. Financial institutions, including First Direct, owned by HSBC, and Scottish Widows, part of Lloyds, took the chance to slash rates on their leading savings deals, but they didn't cut borrowing costs for their mortgage customers. And this is coming as MPs like Conservative Jacob Rees-Mogg have been criticising the Governor Carney and the Bank of England for being overly dramatic about the state of the economy, suggesting that even some of these measures were a bit unnecessary.
The difficulty, it seems to me, is that the bank, in its dire warnings, created a sense of that concern, that the inflation report of May thought that households, after the vote, would defer consumption, that asset prices could fall, and that unemployment would rise. So if our retail spending and stock market are up, and unemployment has fallen. You yourself predicted that there might be a technical recession, that the Bank of England was contributing to a fear in the markets about what would happen in the event of Brexit, which it is now saying that it has corrected. And that seems to me to be at the heart.
Mr. Rees-Mogg, we were absolutely clear-eyed about risk. That's our job. We're charged by Parliament to do that. The next step is not just to observe risk, but is to take steps to address them. We have done that. We have made the crystallization of those risks less likely. I would add, though, that, you know, we're in a position, we'll talk about the current economic situation. It is absolutely welcome that there has been a rebound in some of these confidence surveys and others.
But Governor Carney has further worries on his plate this week. Here's financial expert Martin James.
Recently, the Bank of England cut interest rates from 0.5% to a new low of 0.25%. Now, this is designed to kind of stimulate the economy and to keep everything moving on an even keel. But when the government, Mark Carney, recently went to Parliament to discuss the impact of this, where he explained that there was no excuse for lenders not passing on this reduction to borrowers. Now, this is the reduction to your mortgage, maybe if you've got a standard variable rate, which means you're supposed to more or less follow what the Bank of England are doing. And disappointingly, around about a half of lenders have failed to pass on this cut, citing excuses like they need to put it before their board. Now, the governor has made it clear that he doesn't think this is acceptable, particularly when borrowing costs also aren't being reduced and when savers are being particularly penalised. So watch this space. There's a lot of angry people at the moment wanting to know why the banks aren't passing on these interest rate reductions. And it's not only Mark Carney who's angry about this. Former Pensions Minister Ros Altman has come out to say this interest rate cuts are acting like a tax increase, and that might have actually contributed towards the Brexit result. She's made it very clear that she's unhappy with what's being proposed by the banks, i.e. not reducing that rate, and is actually calling for a national inquiry into the impact of ultra-low interest rates and how they affect us all.
So what is going on here?
Well, when the Bank of England cut interest rates, Mark Carney came out and said quite clearly that he thought that banks had no excuses not to pass on the cut to their borrowers. So essentially what normally happens when the Bank of England cuts or raises interest rates, which it has only done once in the last 7.5 years, but casting our mind back to before then, when interest rates used to actually change with a bit of regularity, banks would come out and they would adjust their standard variable rates, which is the rate that people move to after they've been on a limited term fixed rate deal or tracker deal. And they would sometimes cut their SVR by less than the Bank of England base rate cut. They would sometimes not cut it at all, or they would sometimes pass on the cut in full. And sometimes when rates went up, they would raise it by the amount of the Bank of England base rate cut, or sometimes they'd even raise it by more. But then they would also impose some cuts or rises on their savers as well. And what has long been the accusation levied at the banks and building societies is that they quite often use such a situation in order to load the game a little bit more in their favour. So they'll deliver a bigger cut to savers and a smaller cut to borrowers. Mm. And the Bank of England said that there was no excuse for that this time round. And they even launched a new sort of funding scheme, basically, to pump a load of cheap money into the banking sector and into the financial sector in order to, they said, to try and ensure that those cuts were passed on. Because the bank's cutting rates because it wants to try and stimulate the economy. And by cutting rates, it hopes that there will be that rate cut will be passed on to borrowers. That will then encourage more demand for borrowing, and people will borrow that money and go out and spend it on whatever they spend it on, from, you know, consumer goods to houses. So the bank isn't happy because it thinks that despite putting in a lot of groundwork this time round to try and make sure that that cut was passed on, there's still quite a few lenders who are dragging their heels.
Yeah. So there's no compulsion, of course, that the banks need to follow suit at all.
No, they don't have to cut rates. They don't have to raise rates. I mean, that is the problem with a bank's standard variable rate. It is entirely up to the bank as to what it does. There are a few who have them linked to the Bank of England base rate or their own sort of version of the base rate, but the vast majority of them can do what they like.
Do you think the bank's excuse here is that we're in a very hostile economic environment at the moment, and they're not going to make any changes willingly?
Well, that's what they like to say, isn't it? That it's due to circumstances outside their control. But the traditional, the conventional way that banks make money is they take in money from savers, they pay them a bit of money in interest so that they can do that, and then they lend it out to other people, to businesses or to homeowners, anyone who wants to borrow money at a higher rate. The difference between the two is the margin where they make profit. And if you are decreasing the rate at which the rate that you're giving people for that money, but you're not changing the rate that you're lending it out, that margin increases, which means more profit for the banks. So this is really something to look at as the results come out. If we see that the profits from this dynamic is changing, then they're just rinsing savers, really.
There's rumours, there's whispers, there's talk, there's chat on the street of another rate cut. So is there any point in the Bank of England even doing that? Would that be considered reckless if the high street banks aren't following suit in any way?
The point of the first one, I mean, let's first of all talk about how big these cuts can be. I mean, we started at 0.5%. We've gone down to 0.25%. Mark Carney ruled out again and again negative interest rates. So when any cut is going to be teeny tiny, the material impact of that has to be more to do with sentiment than the actual impact on people spending, and to look like the Bank of England is doing something and to keep people spending money. So I don't really know that it could make that much of a difference. But at the same time, we've seen over the past week or so in particular, this real retaliation against that first rate cut, because it's times were bad enough for savers, and now this is really starting to take the mickey. And we've got people, as the clip had talked about, Ros Altman is saying, well, this is a step too far for savers and pensioners. And she even has linked it to the Brexit vote, that the older people are just getting so miffed at being messed around with their savings.
Don't miff old people. If the government, the Bank of England and all of our main institutions in the UK have ever learned anything, don't miff old people.
And even links this to the Brexit result. So, and if that kind of sentiment gains momentum, I don't know whether it's worth a teeny tiny little rate cut again and upsetting people even further.
Simon, has anybody benefited?
Well, yeah, some people have. Mm. I've got £30 a month off my mortgage because I've got a tracker mortgage. But to be perfectly honest, I think it was the wrong move to cut rates. I think that, you know, near zero interest rate policy has become deeply counterproductive. I think that it is basically delivering a scenario where there's a misallocation of capital. People are chasing risks that they shouldn't be chasing. They're overpaying for things. You know, got government bonds with negative yields. I also think that it is encouraging basically house prices to continue rising, people to borrow more money on mortgages. It's not rewarding savers. And I would say that in a sense, Ros Altman is right, because I don't think that low interest rates are particularly boosting the mood or the confidence of the general population. And in fact, I would say that they're probably contributing to the general malaise, where people are a bit disgruntled, because, you know, for every person who might save a bit of money on their mortgage, well, if house prices keep going up at a rate that is far faster than wages, the next time they want to move, they're going to discover that any of the money that they'd saved on their mortgage has been greatly outweighed by the rise in the cost of the property that they've got to buy. And on the basis that, you know, most people moving home are going up the ladder rather than down the ladder, you know, rising house prices is causing people more problems than any benefits that it's delivering to them. And then you have first-time buyers who, you know, they're looking at it and they're seeing prices rise. And then you've got the older generation who could potentially be the people downsizing, but they're complaining that they're not getting any return on their savings. And if you look at people who are retiring and you know, want to take the safest possible option of an annuity, which would provide them with a guaranteed income for the rest of their life, well, that's disastrous at the moment. You know, retirement income has completely collapsed. And again, you're seeing people pushed into basically thinking they're keeping their money invested in the stock market and drawing down on it, which arguably might be a good idea, but you've got lots of people doing that who are very, very lacking in the confidence that is required to be doing it, and they just don't really know what they're doing, and they feel they've been backed into a corner. So I don't think that low interest rates are doing us many favours, to be perfectly honest.
In related news, This Is Money has been hearing from a fixed-term saver whose term is almost up, and what seemed like a not-so-generous rate at the time, 4.1%, is now absolutely astronomical in comparison with these slashed rates, and they're feeling a bit booted out into the cold at the moment. So does this show the advantage of the fixed term, the rates stayed up despite everything else plummeting?
Well, I think the great irony with this question that Lee has wonderfully answered is that it's very likely that that person who took that 4.1% rate 5 years ago was probably quite unhappy with the 4.1% rate. I distinctly remember many of our readers 5 years ago grumbling extensively about those rates, which basically didn't seem like an awful lot for locking up your money for 5 years. Well, now it looks fantastic. And I think that this is, you know, this, and the problem is you've now got all of these people who might be rolling off these rates, and some of them will be relying potentially, you know, fixed rates are very popular with those people who rely on their savings for their income. And if you're coming off a 4.1% fixed rate and you're staring down the barrel of the best rate that you're now going to get is 2%, you're going to see the income that you're taking from your savings pot halved. And I don't think that's going to be particularly pleasing to many people. So it's tough. The answer really is basically, you're going to get a much worse rate now. You're going to be looking at about 2% is the best you can get, or you're going to have to take some risk with your money potentially and invest it or do something, you know, along those lines.
Where could his money fare better then?
Well, it's It's difficult to say, really. I mean, if he's happy with 2%, actually, that doesn't sound too bad comparatively. That's from Shawbrook. Anything else really requires a level of risk, and it's a matter of how much you're willing to take. There are stocks and shares ISAs. That's one option to reduce risk, you know, diversify a bit. But otherwise, it's a tricky one. There's current accounts as well, actually. It's not a bad solution at the moment. Lots of them offer better rates of interest on balances than savings rates do, which seems ridiculous.
I imagine this is top of all the requests and questions you get at the This Is Money team from people who just want to maximise their savings and are hoping for something that's 2 point something or other at very least.
Well, this was very well read on the day that we published it, take from that what you will. If it was me, my personal choice, because I would be happy with the risk that it was taking, it was if I didn't need this money, you know, in the short term, if this was basically just my savings pot rather than my rainy day fund or, you know, the money I need in case the boiler breaks or something like that, which you shouldn't be investing. My personal preference would be to invest it in an income investment trust where basically, due to the structure of investment trusts, they can hold over some of the money in the good times to help pay out their dividends in the bad times. And you saw some of them basically have grown their dividend payouts for, you know, they've got a history that goes back 50 years. They didn't have to cut them during the financial crisis. And you could be getting that 4% now. Now, obviously, you're going to have to take a lot more risk for that 4% because you're investing it in the stock market than you did 5 years ago when all you did was put it in a savings account. But, you know, if you look at it as I'm parking the money in there, this is the dividend return I'm taking on it. I'm either taking it as income or I'm going to reinvest it to build up the pot. Then over a 5 year period, you know, unless things desperately move against you with a stock market crash, you should probably be okay.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Simon Lambert, who's editor at This Is Money, and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Streis are here for the This Is Money programme and podcast. And it's not just a bad savings landscape that's putting people off, or at least making them hesitate. Nearly half of UK employees are suffering a crisis of confidence over saving for retirement. This is research for the Mail on Sunday. Increased choice combined with economic uncertainty and conflicting financial priorities is producing widespread pension roadblock. Here's Hannah Maundrell.
I think that to some extent choice will be an issue here, but I think the massive problem with pensions is that it's just too big. People don't know enough about it, so they ostrich and they don't really know what to do about it or where to turn. So they don't do anything. I mean, trying to project forward and think about, you know, your saving for your retirement can seem like a really big ask if you don't know anything about it, whether or not you've got a workplace pension scheme. So I think it's not necessarily the choice of options. It's more knowing what to do and where to turn and to make sure that you've got that money there when you retire. I think there's also a degree of scepticism. You know, will I actually ever get to retire? Will I have to work forever? Is it worth saving into a pension for that reason? So I think, you know, choice is only part of the problem here. You know, we've got auto-enrolment coming in, so most people that are working will be paying something into a workplace pension and getting it matched by their employer, which is a really good start. But for most people, that won't be enough to retire on. You know, you can't really rely on the state pension. And certainly if you're younger now, you won't be getting it till later and later. I think, you know, we do all need to be smart about saving for our retirement. However, with so many pressures on your finances now, just from living, that can seem very difficult as well.
That's Hannah Maundrell of money.co.uk. And with annuities giving out less and less, it's getting much less clear where a safe home for your pension pot can be found. Here's chartered financial planner Martin Bamford.
The main alternative now is income drawdown, pension drawdown. And of course, since the pension freedoms, we've got no real limits on that anymore. So you can take money out of your private pension pot to the amount you need to each year. You have to think very, very carefully about sustainability when you do that. You know, how much can you withdraw from your pension pot each year without really running the big risk you're going to run out of money before the end of your lifetime? And there's a lot of academic debate around what a safe withdrawal rate is from pensions. it's probably not going to beat that annuity rate we just talked about. So maybe 4% a year, and you might be pushing it if you try to take any more out of your pension. So about £100,000 pension pot, £4,000 a year of worth of income. As you get older, of course, you can consider increasing that. But we're in a low yield environment right now. I think people in retirement especially have to really temper their expectations about how much they can expect to get from pension pots, from savings, from all types of investments.
So, people are put off from trusting a pension scheme. They're not wrong, are they? And I wonder if it has at its base the fact that people don't really understand what pension schemes are, what they ought to be enrolled for, and how much research they ought to be doing into stuff that's non-workplace based as well.
It's partly a legacy issue, that it used to be that you didn't have to think about it that much. You just worked, and then some of your money that you earned went into your pension, yep. And then your employer put in a bit as well. And at the end, you'd get this gorgeous defined benefit pension that paid out as much as you might need to be able to have what we're seeing now among many sort of 60-some-year-olds, quite comfortable retirements. This is no longer the case. You have to put in more effort yourself and take more control, and you don't get a guaranteed lump sum at the end of it or a guaranteed sum every year. It's dependent on how much you put in and also how that money performs over your working life. So we've got one, more responsibility; two, as you say, we've got more choice through pension freedoms. All these sorts of things that we can now do come with extra responsibility. Mm. So it used to be that you didn't have to think too hard. You just, whatever you had when it came to retirement, you'd bung it in an annuity and you'd get a certain sum every year. You'd only have to make the decision once. Now you can do all sorts of funky things with drawdown, and you don't have to take it out at once, or you can take a bit tax-free and all these different options. This is wonderful to have these sorts of freedoms, but with that uncertainty and choice comes fear as well, I think. I think that's fair to say.
And there's a whole generation of people who say, you know, month to month, they can't afford to release any cash to pot in a pension pot anyway.
That's true. But there's, for so many people, there's sort of rarely a time that it's particularly convenient to put away money that you're not going to use for several decades. But it's, I suppose, about getting into the habit and just a little bit. And also, if you just compound interest, if you just look at what kind of impact it has on your savings if you start earlier versus later. If you start a little bit early on, you only have to save about half as much as if you started later on, and you'd have to be putting away far more, and it would have a considerably higher impact on your living costs.
What do you think, Simon? People of a certain generation, a younger generation, are relying on the pensions angel to help them out when they hit retirement age.
Well, yes, they are. But, you know, I feel sorry for them because they're, you know, maybe their parents' generation actually did have the pensions angel in the form of their workplace, you know, defined benefit scheme, because most people will have had those closed now. You know, they will have been shifted over to defined contributions. But even if you just had 10 years in a defined benefit scheme, then you got a real, really great benefit. My wife used to work for Tesco, and they had a defined benefit scheme. It was a career average, not final salary. And we both worked. You know, I've got a defined contribution scheme. We both paid it. By the time she left Tesco last year, we both paid into our pensions for roughly about the same amount of time. And hers is worth about four or five times as much as mine is, which is that's over about a 9-year period. Mm. So that shows the big difference.
And is that a teeny bit embarrassing for the editor of the This Is Money website?
I have literally no control over the pension scheme that my employer offers me, or over the performance of the stock market. And that is the problem that people face, you know, when they're working nowadays. But I think that for young people who say, I literally have no money to put into this pension, then it's difficult to be lecturing them and saying, well, you have to find the money. But you have to find the money. And it's money that you can't afford not to find. Mm. And the sooner you do it, if it comes out, if your employer offers to match your contributions, then that's free money you're turning down. That gives the big boost to your pension. You get the tax relief on top of it. You could put £100 a month into your pension for probably a cost of about £50 to you. And I think arguably, once you start having that money come out of your salary, within about 3 months, you will basically have forgotten, because you never see that money. It's gone before you get your pay. And if you just start doing that in your 20s, that will make such a huge difference to sitting on your hands and then suddenly one day being 45 and going, I don't have any money in my pension. How am I going to do this?
And auto-enrolment, of course, has lifted that responsibility out of the hands of so many people anyway, haven't they? The former pensions minister, Steve Webb, spoke about a looming pension time bomb. Are we any closer to that? Where is the line? Where's the threshold?
There's two super scary things that are happening. One, people not saving enough and not realising how long we're going to live for and how many years, therefore, we will be in retirement and in relatively good health and so wanting to be doing fun things and maintaining a sort of high standard of living. That's one problem. The other problem comes from these defined benefit schemes that people had that are so jammy if you've got one, but companies are having to stump up now for them, and it's so much money. And the deficit, the amount of money that they have put aside to pay out these pensions versus how much they need, is widening every week, really, and even more so because of the funky business that we've been talking about, that the Bank of England is involved with low interest rates and buying up bonds. So that's the other time bomb that we're going to see, and this could have huge ramifications. We've seen it with the problem with BHS is sort of the most obvious one at the moment, but it's just this huge weight on companies' books that they have to somehow get round. Either it means investing less in their companies and investing less in their current staff because they have to be putting aside for since departed staff who are taking their pensions, or for some of it, it could mean insolvency. It's a huge issue.
In terms of reverse incentives, there's a very steep penalty on withdrawing from the government lifetime ISA. They're meant to be helping people, especially those in a younger age group, save for a home and retirement. Could this prove a bit of a nightmare?
Well, I suppose you have to impose a reasonably hefty penalty in terms of what would be the issue if you tried to get your money out early, because realistically, the problem with people taking their money out early is that that money's meant to be for their retirement. Mm. And this question of whether people could be encouraged to save for pensions, basically, by giving them earlier access to the money or limited earlier access to the money, has one that's been bounced around for years now. It's been being bounced around for as long as I've been a financial journalist. And I have to say that one of the great disadvantages of a pension is also its great advantage. The disadvantage is you can't get your money until the age at which the government says you can get at it. So it's, you know, 55, but it's going to be 60, basically. But the advantage is you can't get your money until the government says you can. And that means that it's sat there, hopefully building up into a nice pot for your retirement. And the easier you make it for people to get that cash, the easier they're going to basically spend it before too early.
And the big excuse that people use is that they want to release it to invest in property. But that's not necessarily the cure either, is it?
Well, then you've got no pension.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really sort of weird hybrid product, this lifetime ISA, and it doesn't seem very thought through to me. I think it makes sense, as Simon says, to lock it up, because you have to work with human psychology, and the propensity towards instant gratification is often too great a temptation, and you just don't want to wreck it with your retirement. So lock it up. If you can't get at it, then you won't spend it. That's probably the only way that's going to work. But allowing you to release it to buy property
seems counterintuitive, doesn't it?
It's a really dangerous game.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
This is Sue in for Georgie, and you're listening to This Is Money in partnership with NSI. The team today comprise the editor Simon Lambert and the personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strice, here with us to share some of their award-winning money journalism from the week. We've been looking at savings, and we as a nation aren't doing so good at the moment. We're not so great at spending either, it seems, on the other side. Research from Market and Visa is showing that clothing and shoe sales fell in August as high street spending took a bit of a hit following the Brexit vote. Consumer spending fell by 1.4% month on month versus a 1.1% rise in July and a 0.5% drop in June. And to cap it off, consumer spending for the year grew at its weakest pace for nearly 3 years, rising a meagre 0.1%. Nothing to be sneezed at, but can this all be down to the referendum and the fallout afterwards? Simon, something to be worried about?
No, not really. I don't think so. I think that it takes a great deal to knock the British consumer off their stride, and I'm pretty sure that Brexit hasn't done that. I think it has knocked confidence. People certainly haven't seen their economic confidence rise over the course of the summer. But then I also think that there's probably going to be a bit of a bounce back in August, you know, because we've seen this in sentiment produced from the PMI surveys, which look at the Purchasing Managers Index surveys, which look at, you know, businesses and their reaction. And you saw this sort of whoa reaction in July, end of June, July, where people went, what's going on here? What's the plan? Oh, there isn't a plan. Uh-oh, what are we doing next? Then you've then seen a bit of stability brought into it, a new prime minister, the sort of vague semblance of a plan, and what's going to happen now? And people have settled down a bit and gone, okay, well, maybe this isn't so bad. And also, I said this last week, but you look at that referendum result, and if you work on the basis of that, more than half of people think that this is good news, so why would their confidence be knocked? And even if you take into account the fact that there might be some of them who thought that voting for Brexit was a good idea, but it might harm the economy and might harm prospects, but they thought that Brexit was a prize that was worth having for that, you're still not in a scenario where everyone thinks that this is terrible news. And also, you've got to look at consumer spending in the light of the fact that prices aren't going up very much. And as prices aren't going up very much, consumer spending doesn't look like it's going up very much, because the way these things are measured, the uplift in prices feeds through into the numbers. So if prices go up by 3%, it usually shows that consumer spending is going up by 3%. People aren't necessarily buying more, they're just buying the same things. It's just the price has gone up.
Okay. Online retail is still going strong, Rachel.
Yeah, and that'll probably continue for a while. There's still, I mean, if you are already thoroughly endorsed into the online shopping way of life, it's easy to forget that other people aren't, and there's still this kind of migration over, and we'll see that trend continue for quite some time.
So maybe it's an indication we're short on time rather than short on money. We're still quite happy to buy and spend on the things that we always were. Further confusing matters, according to the ONS, the cost of living defied expectations and held steady in August as clothing and footwear prices rose slightly, which balanced out food, airfares and fuel. Official figures out this Tuesday showed that UK consumer price inflation was 0.6% last month, unchanged from July, and less than the increase to 0.7% forecast by some, which would have been the highest level since back in November 2014. Are these two set of figures at odds with each other?
I don't think so in particular. I think signs that consumers aren't spending, if you say that it's because prices are falling and then the ONS says prices are going up, it becomes a bit mixed, but you're not looking at the same sets of data. And I think the problem with the inflation figures is, this has always been a problem, is your own personal rate of inflation is going to be completely different to what the ONS puts out as the CPI measure of inflation. So, for example, there's a fair amount of clothing and footwear that goes into those ONS inflation figures. Well, in August, I don't think that I bought a single item of clothing or footwear. Actually, I'm lying. I bought one thing, basically. So, but that basket of goods probably reflects a much greater spend on clothing and footwear than me. So my personal rate of inflation is already different to that, and that's before we go into all the other categories of what did I spend my money on and what did I do. And so if you take any individual person from the population and compare them to that basket, then it's going to be different. But that basket is kind of the average. It's the best approximation of what the average person's spending is. And there have been suggestions that that basket doesn't reflect modern day life. There's a lot of thought that goes into it. There's a lot of things that go in and then get pulled out each year. But does it reflect everybody's lives? It's difficult to say.
Let's move on and look at the travel situation of the moment. Rachel Rickard-Strauss and Simon Lambert from This Is Money are here with me, Sue Dugan, here on Share Radio. Let's take a look at travel. In these uncertain times, sometimes you just want to jet away. Though we've been hearing about Britain's spending habits just now and some of the worries that we're overstretching ourselves, this applies to travel as well, as we splurge abroad without thinking too much about it. Tashima Jackson from Uswitch is talking here on some of the dangers of overspending while you're abroad.
As with every holiday, people tend to let their hair down, they buy a few extra luxuries. Actually, with the pound being weaker when you're buying euros and dollars, it just means that is costing you a little bit more. And the way that people are choosing to manage those debts and then the effect of the aftermath is something that we're quite concerned about. What our research has shown is that a third of people had to rely on overdraft facilities or credit cards to kind of bridge the gap of that overspending. And when you're doing that and you haven't necessarily got a strategy for when you come back and the harsh reality of your holiday being over kicks in, that's what we are campaigning, you know, and encouraging people to look at 0% balance transfer credit cards, look at purchase credit cards as a way to make sure that when they come back they're not feeling the pinch so severely. I think, look, you have to be honest, and it's hard to plan for those things, and the fact that you might want to go out for an extra meal and have an extra glass of wine or an extra beer, for example, those things are really hard to plan for. And what we're certainly not saying is that people shouldn't enjoy luxuries when they're going on holiday. What we're saying is if you have gone over and spent over your budget on holiday, that you need to have a plan and a strategy for when you come back. You need to decide how you're going to manage that extra expenditure so that you can still have a pleasant Christmas, for example.
Caution to the wind when you go on holiday. Don't care about what you wear. Don't care about what you spend, it seems, as well. You guys have got some tips on living a high-class lifestyle while you're abroad on economy prices. Go on, share it with us.
Well, the first thing you can do is you can... If you drive into the airport, you can pay to have someone meet and greet you and take your car off and even have it valeted, you know, while you're there. Although I would say that there are varying degrees of meet and greet parking. And I'm sure Stansted advertises a meet and greet parking. I'm sure they call it meet and greet. And I've used it before. It's very convenient because you basically get to pull into the short stay car park. And if you book it in advance, it's actually no more expensive than many of the other car parks. But you do get the convenience of the short stay car park. But you don't really, it's not really meet and greet. You have to take your keys into an office and give them to someone, which to me, I mean, I suppose I'm meeting and greeting them, yeah. But I'm not sure that's what meet and greet most people think of. You could pay for a lounge, for access to a lounge. Now, to me, this has always seemed a kind of very frivolous thing to do.
Oh, no, 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 no. But I disagree.
Yeah, so I had this experience last year on a flying back on a business trip from New York where someone else had paid for the lounge for me. And actually, it was the Virgin Lounge, and it was great. It was absolutely brilliant. And also our flight was delayed, so we managed to get quite a lot of use out of it. Free food, free drinks, a comfortable place to sit. And then when you think about what you probably would manage to spend in the airport, there is an argument that by the time you've fed and watered yourself and then, you know, got bored and gone off for some retail therapy, that actually you might save yourself some money by going for the lounge option. Now, obviously, the problem is like we're paying for all these options. You don't get yourself more room on the plane, do you?
No, unless you really are paying for something pretty premium. What is it, turn left, they say?
Yeah.
And bigger seats,
if you want to fly business class or first class, that's an awful lot more money on your ticket.
And if you do overspend, if you do come back and you look at your credit card bill and actually you've eaten out more often than you thought you would, you've treated yourself generally more than you thought you would, do you need to pick up there and then and start accounting for that afterwards as soon as possible?
I guess the first thing to do is make sure that if you've got debt that you're spending as little as you can on it. So make sure that you're paying off the most expensive debts first, moving them around if you can to make them cheaper. If they're on credit cards with a high rate, at least make sure you're paying the minimum amount. And perhaps is your overdraft cheaper or is that more expensive? Weighing them all up, making sure that it's in the right place.
You've got to cinch your belt a little tighter, don't you, afterwards. The team from This Is Money are here with editor Simon Lambert and Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And finally, let's talk about facts, figures, numbers, data. We like to think we use these for good, but what happens when the numbers are put to ill use through bad intentions or simple neglect? It's the subject of a new book called Weapons of Maths Destruction. The author is Cathy O'Neill, who's a data scientist and mathematician from the MathBabe blog, with an example of when all of these numbers actually work against us.
So imagine that we data scientists develop an incredibly good algorithm that predicts health problems of everybody. And maybe we use, you know, really like DNA data. Maybe we use, but maybe we only use consumer data. And that's sort of the thing that big data is good at, is figuring out things that aren't directly related, but indirectly related. But in any case, we have this amazing algorithm that can anticipate when you're going to get sick. If that algorithm were in the hands of your doctor, your doctor could help you stay well, and that would be a great thing. Mm-hmm. But if that same algorithm were in the hands of an insurer, then they could anticipate your future illness, and they could charge you in advance for the illness that you're going to have in the future. That's an example of the kind of thing that insurance companies really, really get excited about when they think about data science.
Rachel, you've been talking to Cathy this week. What do you make of the book?
It's brilliant but utterly frightening, actually. Really, just to have all in one place all of the different ways that data is used. The data itself, and actually the compiling of the data, is not what she's concerned about. She says that algorithms, not inherently terrible, it's just the ways that they're used and who they're used by, and also our awareness of that process. So she has so many different examples going through kind of all different life stages on how it could be used again in your the pricing of your health premiums, yeah. in where police decide to patrol, in terms of what jobs you might get and how your job applications are viewed. That one I found particularly interesting. She said that a lot of the time when there's sort of a vast quantity of job applicants, or even when there aren't applicants but an employer will want to go out and find potential people to invite to apply, they will use data to look at, well, what does an existing good employee that we have look like, and they'll sort of weigh up the different things about them, and then they will go out and seek to replicate that with other people, which is fine. Often that works and you do end up with other good people, but it will rule out people who don't necessarily fit into that model already. So there's sort of on big scale uses like that, but then there's also little things like a company can have data on you so that when you phone up they know whether to leave you on hold or to answer your phone call straight away. Data could pop up on their screens about how much you earn or how much you spend with them, or whether you have shown interest in spending money with them in the past, which is not the end of the world, but I don't know how many of us really have a sense of how much data on us is being held and that it's being used in this way.
Scarily more than we realise, perhaps. What does Cathy suggest be done about it? That we try and leave less of a trail?
No, just, I think, more of an awareness of it. And the problem with algorithms is that they can't learn. People learn. If they get it wrong, then they just keep getting it wrong, and sort of the algorithm sort of hones in further and further and further. So you sort of need both, I think. You can use algorithms, but make sure that you have some kind of influence as well about how they're being used, and checks on them.
Let the figures flow, but with a bit of a human nudge along the way, occasionally as well. Simon Lambert, thank you.
Thank you.
And Rachel Rickard-Strauss, thank you.
Thanks very much.
The team from This Is Money, brought to you in association with NSNI.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.